know, one of the things that I think in our home when I grew up, our family, those who know my family, my father is a very, very spontaneous person. And I see Ellen is smiling. So really this is, and I picked up that trait a little bit too. And sometimes when you plan conferences, people like 6 months in advance, I can't plan things like that. Like I can plan the concept, the idea, but all the details and particulars, 6 months in advance or 3 months in advance is a long time. So we're working here on 3 days in advance. I think I first contacted Dr. Novak last Friday when she was on vacation. Actually, her secretary was very nice, and we made contact last Friday when we realized that we're going to have to tweak the schedule. And I really want to thank her for her extraordinary lengths, just arriving back yesterday on a red-eye flight, and to come here sort of right afterwards. I really want to give you a great hakaratato, and we appreciate it, not just for your, having you be well, and especially in the circumstances. For those who are unaware, Dr. Novak was just recently, as of July 1st, became the Dean of the Israeli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration at Yeshiva University, a very important and important position. I took courses in Israeli when I went to YU a long time ago, and she has an appointment in the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at North Shore Long Island Jewish Health System. She deals in areas of child and family and health psychology, dealing with the connection between education and wellness. She's a well-known speaker, many conferences, and really a tremendous asset to our community in general. And it's a pleasure to have you and your son and your husband who will be joining us a little bit later this afternoon. Without further ado, Dr. Shah.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Do you need me to use the microphone for the recording? Is that better?
It doesn't matter.
Can you hear me fine without it? You'll tell me if you need me to use it, but I'd rather not be tethered.
Right.
So I did get the call from Jay when we were in a part of the Rocky Mountains where we had phone service. Even though the very first picture I have of our Rocky Mountain vacation was my husband taking a picture of me at a phone booth. Because we haven't seen them in so long that we didn't know what phone booths were. But then we were wishing for a phone booth, because when we went to our second destination, we only had cell phone service if you stood by the big propane tank for the lodge and angled your face away from the propane and towards the lake. But it really was wonderful, and I want to thank Jay not only for reaching out to me and tolerating the craziness of trying to pull this together on short notice, but also for allowing me to come off a plane, do nothing but laundry and repacking, and not have to cook for Shabbos. So the power of positive thinking, right? I'm going to talk today about cognition and metacognition and its impact on health and wellness. And I'm going to give you a choice to either focus on yourself and I see this as a workshop, as a hands-on workshop, so use it for something in your own life that you want to kind of play with and work on, or think about a patient or someone in your life that you care about, a spouse. Those are there later. You don't need them for now.
I just want to put it under the projector to make it.
I'm glad that an academic hard work is. If they say ivory tower is useless, it's very useful publication. I would like to begin. You heard a little bit about me, but what I will just say is that I'm trained as a clinical psychologist. I've worked for the first years of my professional career, I'm too old to admit how many years, in medical centers and in teaching hospitals, training medical practitioners and psychologists. And then 8 years ago, moved to Yeshiva University and wondered, what does the Department of Jewish Education want with a psychologist? Like, what do I have to offer? Yes, I'm a child psychologist, but I don't know about curriculum. I don't know how to teach Limudei Kodesh. What do they want with me? And what I found was that in exactly the same way that physicians and nurses and psychologists were hungry to learn about how the brain processes the world and how that impacts our life, so too were educators. really in need of an understanding of the human mind and how it develops. I come from a tradition in psychology that is very different from the typical Freudian tradition. I'm a behavioral and cognitive behavioral psychologist. So long before positive psychology became popular, I was thinking about and working with my patients and my students on the power of thought. Despite the fact that I think of myself as somewhat of a pioneer in that way, I do remember, again, I'm not going to say when, but when I was doing my internship at Beth Israel Medical Center in New York, I was stunned when a colleague, there were only three of us in the intern cohort, when a colleague said she was leaving clinical psychology to go do research on stress and cancer. Now, right now when I say that, nobody's jaw drops, right? Stress and cancer, we know they're related. But I will tell you that in those days, the idea that stress would have an impact on a physical entity that you could see in a microscope, like cancer cells, was ludicrous. She might as well have told me she was going to go study UFO sightings in Area 54. I thought this was bizarro world. No way that stress is related to disease. And I can't believe now I'm even saying that, that there was a time that we thought stress is not related to disease. But believe it or not, there still exists a time, and there are people now who think that, you know, we are a biological entity from the neck down, and then you go to psychologists or psychiatrists from the neck up, and that's your mental entity. But we know that they're very, very connected. So one of the things I want us to do today is to look at what cognition and metacognition are, to learn how they develop and how we can develop and maintain healthy thinking for ourselves and the people we care about. And we'll consider some particular paradigms of this developing field called positive psychology and how they impact that. But in the idea of self-exploration, we're a too large a group for us to introduce ourselves out loud to everyone. But I'm going to ask you several times today to turn to the person next to you, to your partner, and to engage in a brief conversation. The signal that I want you to end that conversation to wrap up is I will hold up three fingers and I'll say 3, 2, 1, and then I want you to regroup and focus back. So we'll do that a couple of times, so just so you know, 3, 2, 1, so I don't wind up screaming at you like a bad school teacher, okay? So what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to turn to the person next to you and introduce yourself with the following sentence. I'd like you to say, "Hi, I'm Rona, and I have the kind of mind that," and fill in the blank. So I might say, "Hi, I'm Rona, and I have the kind of mind that loves puzzles but hates things without solutions." Or I might say, depending on the day, especially driving some of those Rocky Mountain roads, "Hi, I'm Rona. I have the kind of mind that finds treachery around every corner." Got the idea? Turn to the person next to you. Tell them your name and a little bit about what kind of mind you have. Okay, and 3, 2, 1. Would anybody feel, if anyone feels comfortable, you don't have to share, anyone feel comfortable sharing the kind of mind they introduce themselves as having? Don't all jump at once. Yes.
I have a mind that likes details, that likes to put together a picture from the bits and pieces.
Okay. Anyone else?
I have the kind of mind that finds these sort of open-ended exercises extraordinarily awkward.
Okay, anyone else? Yeah.
I have a kind of mind. I like to work things out logically.
Mm-hmm. Boy, parenting must be fun.
the most illogical thing in the world, yeah.
I don't want to take this in a different direction, but I'm just wondering, when you talk about positive thinking or stress and illness, when someone does get sick, I personally found like a lot of guilt feelings getting sick, and when my son was sick, having like the rabbi say to me, you should do a cheshbona nefesh, like, how do you handle, and when people say when you're sick, you should always be like, if you're happy, the results are better, so does that mean that I wasn't happy and that's why bad things happened to me?
Right.
Not that bad things happened to me, but...
It's a really critical point, and there are happy mediums that we need to find in this work. One area that we're going to talk about, and I think we have to be very careful about, is avoiding the Pollyanna end of the spectrum, which is if you think happy thoughts, all will be well. You know, if we daven with emunah, thank God, and hopefully we will, all will be well, and you have to believe in it, but I have a Haredi branch of the family who in Eretz Yisrael buys lottery tickets, and if you tease him about buying lottery tickets, he'll say, listen, I have absolute emunah, but, you know, I have to do my part. That's his paradigm. You know, I have to do my part. If I just daven to win the lottery, but I don't buy the ticket, that's foolish. I have to do my part. On the other hand, buying the ticket is no guarantee. Doing the davening is no guarantee. At the other part of the spectrum that we have to be very, very careful about is teaching people or help having them believe that there's a one-to-one correlation between cognition and events, between prayer and action. I'll tell the story. My son is here. Our youngest son, who is a YU student now, and is here with us for Shabbos. The first time we went to Eretz Yisrael, I think he was 7, turning 8. And we made a whole big thing about your tefillot on a petek by the kotel. It is the most holy place. Your tefillot go straight to Shamayim from there, and Hashem sees your tefillot. He wrote, it took 3 hours, his petek was this long, because he had no handwriting ability at the age of 7. So he wraps up this big petek, and he's going to put it in the wall, and what does he ask my husband in the men's section after he puts it in the wall? He says, could we now go up behind and see God read it? We have mail slots where I live. We don't have mailboxes. We have mail slots in the door. He thought there's a direct correlation. This is Yashar to Hashem. He's picking up the mail this afternoon. He's got my tefillah in his hand. So we have to be very careful, whether we're parents, educators, or in the helping profession, that we not say, daven, this will happen. I got a call maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago. There was a local boys' yeshiva where the Rebbeim knew that one of the boys' elementary school, one of the boys' parents was having open heart surgery. The whole class were going to daven, he should have a refuah. Comes out of surgery, the news is good, he tells the class, your tefillot were answered. The man was nifter the next day. Now what do you tell him? So we have to be very, very careful. I'll talk more about it on Shabbat in that talk, about how do we talk in ways that we are communicating the power, but also the limits of thought. Thought has an impact. To me, it's exactly the same. Your question is exactly the same as, do nutritionists tell us to eat healthy? Yeah. But you know what? If you have bad genes, you may wind up with diabetes, even with great eating habits. You narrow your risk. I still have hypertension. I have high cholesterol. I don't eat cholesterol. I don't eat anything that has cholesterol. I mean, I really don't eat a high cholesterol diet. Wait, now you're going to see me eat red meat here, probably. But at home, I don't cook red meat. I don't like eggs. I don't like cheese. I'm very easy. But I have a family history of high cholesterol. So, you know, there's only so much that's in our hands. And I think you have to have a respectful view of that. Okay. Anyone else who wants to share any of what their mind is? Yeah.
I have a very creative mind, but I'm also structured.
Okay.
Somewhat, you know, but usually I know people who are very creative but all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm creative, but I still creative, but I crave structure.
Okay. One of the things that we're going to discover together today is that understanding how your mind works and what your natural mental habit is an important step on the road to retraining or retooling your mind. Yeah.
When you say how your mind works, is that your personality?
I don't know how to answer that question. Psychologists could write, you know, tomes on what personality is. I think of it as a mental habit, and I do not believe, I actually just had to submit topics for a Rosh Hashanah panel, and one of the topics I want to do with a group of my colleagues and verbatim and whatever, which I think is perfect for Rosh Hashanah, is the idea of change and how much human beings, how much change is capable. Can a bad person become a good person? Can a good person become bad? What's the spectrum of change? I tend to believe in the unbelievable resilience and flexibility of human beings. And so while we have a core nature, I'll give you again my own example. I'm not a sitter. I don't do vacations at the beach well. So we were just in the Rocky Mountains. We did, for two really old people, a lot of hiking. But I'm able to say, you know what? An afternoon at the hot springs, just looking at the mountains, is nice too. I know my natural tendency is fill every day with 8,000 things, and then I'll, you know, I won't give myself some relief. So I can work against my nature, but my natural inclination would always be to go in that direction. That's the way I think about personality. If it's your natural temperament or inclination, it doesn't mean you're stuck there. It means you have to work harder to get beyond it. Okay. Consider, for our work together today, you have two sets of handouts, one that has the slides that are here, and another that has, it's like a worksheet, that has blank boxes. So for our time together, I'd like you to consider, and jot down some notes about it, just your example, anything that will make you remember, in the blank box, the first blank box, I'd like you to consider either a stressful or annoying situation that you are currently faced or that you face, or that a patient, again, you don't have to be you, it doesn't have to be you, it could be someone you cared about, faced. So think about it, it could be a tiny stress. I hit traffic on the Cross Bronx Expressway, but it will work better for this to think about something that was toxic, was significant. It doesn't have to be a huge health issue, it could be, you know, my teenage daughter has a messy room, and we fight about it endlessly. It could be my job situation is insecure. I had a tiff with my spouse or my boss or my neighbor. Think about a stressful situation. Take a minute to jot down which one you want to think about and work on. They only have big fat markers. Imagine that you could, and this is how old I am, this is how long I have been doing this. I used to say to people, I want you to think about what's the record. Remember those? Records, LPs, 45, 78, right? Remember those? I want you to imagine the record that's playing in your head about that situation. And it might be something that's stuck in the groove and it's playing the same thing over and over and over again. What is the thought process about that? Then I had to, you know, get more modern, and I said, what's the cassette that is playing stuck in a loop? And then I had to say, what's the CD? And now I remember, spin the wheel on your iPod. Remember the wheels on the first iPod? Now it's, you know, what's playing in your playlist? What's in your shuffle list in your iPod that's playing over and over in your mental iPod? What's the thought process? And you have a second box there to jot down some of the thoughts that are coming either when you're in that stressful situation or when you think about it. They're not going to stick well, it's fine. Okay. Again, totally voluntary. Anybody want to share some of the thoughts? Yes. Example, because we often coexist both positive and negative thought processes. It's not unusual that if you look at the list of stressors, I think it's now number 2 or 3 is marriage as a stress. And people would say, well, why is that a life stress? It's a great thing. Yes, but even great things come with stress. Change comes with stress. Someone else.
I would like to share with you my experience at the Yom Kippur War.
Okay.
I'm 19 years old, and here is coming the news about my close friends who got killed in the war. For my classmates, 6 of them. For my army unit, 13 of them. So this is the immediate circle of Levayot, Shiva, Nichum Avelim, and years after years, keeping in touch with the family. So you're asking about feelings?
Thoughts. What's your thought?
My thought is a big question about Hashgacha, Prati. About stability, about certainty in life. Values that worth giving you life for. Is it enough?
Yeah, it's wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. Any other thoughts? It's a hard one to follow, right? 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 Yeah.
I just had cataract surgery. I'm so nervous. I was afraid my mother has bad vision, has cornea issues, etc. I was afraid of going in and coming out blind in one eye. And I was a wreck when I was in Israel 2 days before that. I was a mess. Couldn't enjoy the trip. Worried about coming back the next day having it. Was knocked out during the surgery. They normally want you to be awake. I was totally knocked out. Woke up and everything's fine. But now I have to have the other one done.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'm worried about the direction that America is going in and how we as Jews.
So the thought is wonder about the U.S. in the future, and the other thought is I'm going to call it kind of helplessness. These are cousins, by the way, kind of hopelessness and helplessness. I hear in the wonder about the U.S. Not a hopeful wonder. A negative wonder, and then the helplessness, what can I do about it? So we've got an array, even in just hearing 4 or 5 of us, of ways of thinking that seem, every single one of them, seem perfectly suited, right? Totally appropriate. However, also every single one of these, imagine if that were playing over and over and over. If you're thinking every single minute now, well, I dodged that bullet, the first one, but now, the next one, for sure, I'll be blind. How's she going to be going into her next surgery? Imagine if every time that a simcha approaches in a family, please God, that should happen a lot, all we think about is, I'll be exhausted, I won't be able to wait for the end, I won't be able to enjoy it, it's just imagine if this gentleman who described so avidly the incredible loss, imagine what it was like for you now to see the Masav and see young people in the same place. It's like, you know, deja vu all over again, going through the same painful experiences. And imagine if all you think about is, if all you had in your head is Eretz Yisrael, how many years, how many wars, how many times? If that's the way we thought, what would our days and nights be like? Every single one of these, if they took over our mental iPod, if it's all we thought about, it could cause us some trouble. So where does positive psychology, cognition, and metacognition come in helping us through this? First of all, a word about positive psychology. Some people think positive psychology means, oh, let's just all be happy. It's all about happiness and positive. No. Positive psychology came about because the original study of the human psyche was based exclusively on pathology. And in some ways, you've seen the evolution in medicine as well. The origins of medicine were disease. It wasn't necessarily on health promotion. It was, we'll be reactive. We'll wait till you get ill, and then we'll provide curative strategies. And that's the way all of psychology began. We'll wait till you're crazy, sick, pathological in some way, and then we'll come up with some way of fixing it. Psychology really woke up as early as the 60s, but much more recently in the 80s, and said, you know, it's very, very interesting that when we do research, for example, on disease process, psychological disease process, what we go into inner cities and we find the very poor outcomes that happen for inner city kids who have poor education, live amidst violence and poverty, and rat-infested tenements, we always find a small group of kids who do well. We find in every study of mental illness a small group that's not affected, and that even in war, even in trauma, even in natural and man-made tragedies, seems to do well. What if instead of studying the pathology for a change, we looked at those resilient people and tried to figure out what's their process, and is that something that would help all human beings grow and develop and be resilient in the future? That's really what positive psychology is it's learning about resilience from those who are resilient. The research has been extraordinarily compelling in terms of the connection between thinking, positive thinking, mental habits, and health. There's study after study, but I'll just give you, this is my typical example that I think makes it very non-research and very clear. You wake up in the morning with a headache. I assume that most of you had that experience. It happens. At some point in your morning, you notice that you have a headache. In a week or so, 9-10 days, we'll all wake up in the morning with a headache because it will be Tisha B'Av and we will be caffeine detoxing. And we will all have our, you know, I haven't eaten and I need my caffeine headache. So you wake up with a headache. And if, in fact, you say to yourself, oh, I didn't have enough caffeine today, or it's hay fever season, that's what's causing my headache, you might take your Claritin or your Tylenol or have a cup of Starbucks, go along your day, and your stress level is relatively low. You've explained your headache. Your cognitive thought process has made sense of that experience in a way that decreases your stress. What if you wake up in the morning with the exact same headache, but we just frame it with a different cognitive thought process? So instead now of thinking, oh, it's my hay fever, it's my caffeine withdrawal, we wake up and we say, I think the headache's on my right side. I think it's over here, right side. You know what, my left fingers are tingling. I think if I look in the mirror and I do the tongue test, I think it's a little uneven, my tongue. I think I'm stroking. I think I'm having a stroke. You know, there's a woman in my community, only a few years older than me, who had a stroke driving on the highway. We thought she was never going to be back. She's back, thank God, she survived, but her life is never going to be the same. That's probably what's happening to me. I know if I go to the ER, by the way, they won't even find it. I probably have the silent stroke. You know, they won't, on my MRI will be normal. They'll send me home. I'll plop tomorrow night on the bathroom floor. I know that's what's happening. Now what's my day like? Now what's my stress level?
And don't you know, by the way, that the rest of the day, I'm constantly pricking to see how numb are the left fingers, I'm looking at my tongue, I'm hyper-focused, I'm hyper-vigilant, because the thought process around that stressor of the headache escalated the physical symptoms and escalated my anxiety. And of course we know, anyone in the room who is a physician knows, the vicious cycle, that once we get the stress level up, then we've got all kinds of physiological processes going on that do, in fact, make us feel sick. It doesn't feel good to have palpitations. You do think you're having a heart attack. Believe me, I was at the first day we landed in the Rockies, the easy hike we were going to do, a tree fell on the trail and it was closed. Another hike we were going to do, there was a forest fire. You probably shouldn't vacation where I go. There was a forest fire closing that road. So we did our third option, which is called idyllically Sunshine Meadows, where an old school bus takes you to the top of a mountain that is over 7,000 feet high. And then you begin your hike at 7,000 feet. This is our first day off the plane. And I didn't feel good. Luckily, a friend had told me before, you know, the altitude does make it hard to breathe. So take it easy. So I had an explanation for how I was feeling, was able to say, okay, we'll take it a little bit slow and we'll be okay. So that's the research on health. There is also research on how our thinking affects our attitude and the choices we make, the behavioral choices we make. And for this, I want to show you a video. Anybody here hear the term of learned helplessness? You've heard it before. The classic experiment was done by Marty Seligman years ago with dogs. I'm going to show you a video of learned helplessness induced in a college classroom in about 5 minutes. You're going to see an amazing example of learned helplessness. Let's just hope that the technology gods smile on us. Here we go.
Everybody have one? If you would, just do them one at a time, and I will tell you when you
can. Can you hear it? You tell them, just go to number two. Go ahead, do number three, she says.
What happened by the time you got to the third word? Because I'm here to tell you,
It's remarkable, right? So that's just an incredibly, you know, quick and easy demonstration of how what you're thinking. They're looking around the room, they see their colleagues are doing, and they start thinking, I must be stupid, I must be incapable, I must be incompetent, and self-fulfilling prophecy, then it is. And there are, again, studies after studies with all different kinds of conditions in the laboratory that demonstrate that once we have the idea playing in our mental iPod, I'm not capable, I'm not competent, this isn't going to go well, I'm going to be blind, it affects the choices we make. It affects whether we will go on that date, whether we will go for the job interview, whether we will try that new recipe. It affects the behaviors that we do and the choices that we make because of our thoughts. So thoughts make a difference, thoughts matter. Just a word about the difference between cognition and metacognition. Cognition is the thought process that goes on in our brain. We are getting, I'm very excited to be alive at this time because, again, I'm old enough to have gone from when the only window we had into the brain was x-rays and MRIs, and we're now at PET scans that can show where, you know, if you drink radioactive glucose and you go on PET scan, you can see where the fuel is being used in the brain, hence which part of the brain is using. We have evoked potentials, which allows us to study the electronic combined area from the skull of what's happening beneath it in that region of the brain. And I believe that we will get to a point where we will have research on the level of neurotransmitter studies that will really allow us to know more about how thoughts move across the brain. But we still don't know exactly what the process of cognition is biologically. We don't know exactly what a thought looks like. It looks something like a synaptic neurotransmitter response, but is it multiple? You know, I don't think there's one neuron per thought. You know, it's a complex interaction of biochemical processes. But the cognition is what happens in our brain. Metacognition is thinking about our thinking. It's being meta to the thought. So I'll be blind is not metacognition. That's cognition. Metacognition is I notice I'm having panicky thoughts. That's metacognition. That's thinking about your thinking. We have impact on both, but it turns out that the metacognition is a very good vehicle to impact what happens in our through our thought processes. And like I said, kind of the first step is often uncovering what our mental habits are and how we think in general. Now I'm going to share with you some of the most common cognitive distortions. We all have, someone asked before about personality, we all have, based on our personality, certain distortions that we're more likely to go to, we're more likely subject to than others. We can do any of these at any point in time. And doing them from time to time is by no means pathological or pathognomonic. It's not a problem that from time to time I engage in black and white thinking. Seeing things in extreme or opposite ways, a hint that you're doing that is when you use words such as never, always, all, or none. I can never make cakes that come out right. You know, that's black white thinking. Well, my mama bread's pretty good. You know, my cupcakes are okay. I picked a silly example. But very, very often, anyone here a parent of an adolescent? I'm so sorry. You have my heart going to you. We're blessed with our three sons, I said, well, just please do not let me have three adolescent boys in the house at the same time. But that didn't work. The biology did not cooperate, and we did have three adolescent boys in the house at the same time. Adolescents live in this world. Everybody hates me. There's nothing in my closet I can wear. Right? If you have girls, you've heard that one before.
nothing you cook is the way I like it. That is all we're done. I didn't get a good grade on that test. My life is over. You know, that kind of all or none, although that's a different category, which we'll talk about in a minute. So I've given you some examples of black or white thinking, and as we go through them, see if you recognize yourself or others in your life. Forever thinking. Forever thinking is the habit of feeling that whatever is happening now, I'm stuck. This is how it will be. And the clue are words like, you know, never, always. You know, the brothers are fighting, they'll never get along. Things are tough at work now, they'll never calm down. This traffic will never, you know, open up. It's forever. I'm going to be stuck on this highway forever. That's an absurd one, but it does feel like that sometimes. Blaming. This is also, kids do this really well, but believe it or not, adults do this also a lot. Professional athletes, a lot. Blaming. Blaming others for things that you should take responsibility for. With kids in schools, I see it all the time. I failed the test because the Rebbe made it too hard. You know, or sometimes I failed the test because my brother made too much noise yesterday and I couldn't study. It's always somebody else's fault. There's some other reason. But again, you'll see it in adults all the time. Watch the 6 o'clock news. You'll hear it. I guarantee it. You will hear somebody do this on the 6 o'clock news who's, you know, caught stealing something or doing something wrong, and it will be, anything from I had a hard life as the blame responsibility to, well, they didn't post the signs adequately, so it didn't occur to me that I shouldn't go around that curve at 300 miles an hour, you know, or politicians are very good at this also, yeah. Binocular vision, this is an important one. Because if you've used a pair of binoculars, you know that when you look through them in one direction, they make things much larger than they are. Flip them, and things are much smaller. Binocular vision is the inaccurate reading of real-life situations, either to blow them out of proportion or to minimize them. Either direction can be problematic. We do not want to minimize danger. We don't want kids walking around saying, oh, so what? There are internet predators out there. What are they going to do if I give them my phone, my number, my address? What's the likelihood someone's coming to find me? You know, and that guy who asked to meet me at the mall, I'm sure it's no big deal. We don't want that. On the other hand, we don't want ourselves or our kids to blow things out of proportion and say, if I even press the on button in the computer, that's it, my identity is stolen. Everybody knows who I am. I'll never have a moment's peace again. And every evil in the world is going to come grab me from my place and just seduce me. You'll pardon me if my people who are anti, who don't have computers at home, I don't mean to at all expose my views. But the point is, there's a balance in seeing things and seeing levels of stress, danger, real. There are real issues on this list. None of these thoughts, by the way, were based on totally inaccurate or inappropriate realities. There are consequences of cataract surgery. It happens. There are real reasons to worry about the U.S. in the future and the direction of our country, to question faith in times of difficulty, to feel overwhelmed, even at a simple. Those are real. The question is, how do I magnify or minimize it in a way that might get me into trouble? Dark glasses. Have you heard the expression, looking at the world through rose-colored glasses? This is the opposite. Everything is bad. Everything, thinking only about the negative parts of things. I tell this story all the time because it has stayed with me so powerfully in my life. I remember, I was probably 11 or 12. This is when I knew that my personality, as much as I'm very much my mother's daughter, that I knew that I was very different from who she is. My mother's a wonderful woman, God bless her. Maeve Esther, and she should live and be well, along with my father, enjoying happily Florida's sunshine. But we went into a diner or someplace. We were getting ice cream, some ice cream store. I must have been 11 or 12 years old. And in the first, like, booth, when you walked in the restaurant, there was a family that clearly had some
degenerative or birth defect so that everybody's hands were deformed. Everybody's hands were curled in. It might have been an arthritic problem. I don't know. I was too young. I didn't really notice. I just noticed that they all had the same deformity. It was a two parents and a teenager older child. And my mother's response, which is the typical, my mother's not Eastern European, but it's the typical Eastern, I give up. You shouldn't know. You shouldn't know from it. It's so sad. It's so terrible. I give up. Look at this. So damaged. So hurt. So terrible. And I looked at my mother and I said, how wonderful. A family's having ice cream. And even with their disabilities, they go to a nice restaurant, the same restaurant we go to, and they're all eating that dinner. Well, I don't understand. Like, why are you crutching and crepsing and I didn't get it. And I realized then that my mother has permanent paranoid dark glasses on. And that part of my, I think, adaptation growing up with someone who said, you know, don't call the dog a Jewish name. Because when you call out to the dog, you know, Motzi, come in, why does everyone have to know you're Jewish? You know, that dark paranoid, you never know who's out there, that my adaptation to that was to become a much more, let's focus on the positive. Not ignoring danger by any means. I inherited her anxious genes. They run very strong in my family. We're really good at worrying. You want to see worrying? We're like the card carrying. We've won an award for it. One other funny story. The family was all together. Like, the entire extended family was in a van coming back from Masada to Yerushalayim. And our tour guide says, oh, maybe we'll go along that road so you could see, I can't even remember, what into the cliffside you could see some monastery or something carved. Can't remember what the site is there. The road is one lane. There are mountain goats that you're sharing it with. The van is like this. And in the van is like 15 people of our entire extended family. And the whole conversation is, do you have an Ativan? Do you have Valium? What do you have? We'll have something, because I'm not going to make it back to Yerushalayim unless somebody gives me some medicine to deal with this. And I was like, this is so cool. I was very anxious, but I was very intrigued because I had no idea the numbers of people who were on anxiolytics. very interesting. Personalizing is thinking that random things are directed at you. I know they set up that speed trap on I-80 just because they knew I had to get here on time. I know, that's why they did it. They did it to catch me, right? Isn't that the reason? That's personalizing. And again, you'll hear people who do this all the time, who make assumptions that literally it rained because I had a symptom today. You know, if they did that because of me. Again, none of these are problematic if they happen on occasion. So, before we go to changing, we're going to play a little activity game. Let me see if I have time. 30. Yeah. So I'm going to pass out the. Don't worry about the colors on the index cards. Take two cards and pass. And in the interest of good pedagogy, I'm not letting anybody sit still for 2 hours. This is what we are going to do. When you get your two index cards, you are going to write two examples of one on each card of any of the negative thought patterns that I just gave. So for personalizing, it might be the cop at the speed trap was waiting there just to ruin my day. That might be your example. Do not write which category of thought distortion it is. You're going to try to stump your colleagues in the room. So everybody's going to write one on each card. Then when I say go, everybody's going to stand up. You are going to circulate in the room. When someone approaches you, you're going to hand them your index card. They're going to read one of your options and see if they can adequately and correctly put it in the right category. If they do, they walk away with your card. They get to keep the index card with your example. I will repeat it again. After you write your two examples, you're going to stand up. If someone approaches you in the room, they get to read one of your cards and say, oh, I think that's an example of personalizing. No, I think that's blame game. If they're right, if they're correct, you give them the index card. they get to keep your index card. If they are incorrect, you keep your index card. If they do not get the correct category, okay? We'll do that for a few minutes. We'll see who winds up with the most cards. You should write two examples. One on each card. Anyone, you have, I think, six different examples. Black-white thinking, forever thinking, binocular vision, dark glasses, blaming, or personalizing. On each card, write an example of one of those types of negative thinking, of cognitive distortion. So you might have one example of forever thinking and one example of dark glasses, but don't write what it's an example of. Just write the story. In other words, I said I can't bake a cake. My cakes never come out good. Just write the example.
What if it can actually be in two categories?
We'll get to that afterwards. But you'll have one that's in your head. You'll have the correct answer in your head. Things people have said to you, things you've heard. How are we doing? Yes, people have? Yes, does everybody have?
No.
No? You have at least one?
This exercise is impossible.
Right. I'll do like she does. It's really not hard. It's very easy. You should be able to do this. Everybody should be done by now. Make you all learn helpless by love. Learn helpless by love. Right? She's so good at that teacher telling us. It's really not hard. Okay. Let's go with what we have. Everybody stand up. Take your cards with you. Approach someone, ask for their example. Do not, what I don't want you to do, I don't want you to swap. So when you approach someone, if you share a card with them, then move on to the next person. You follow what I'm saying? Don't then ask that person for theirs. Move to the next person.
You have to pick one.
Just one. Just one example per person, then go to the next one.
No.
Thank you.
Because
you know, batal b'shishim, like, doesn't matter if you have OCD. It's every little drop matters if you have OCD. So, you know, davening with kavana is something that most of us who are from, I hope, really try every single time that we daven, to daven as if we're davening. Not, you know, I love it when people during davening, like you see this, during the week, during davening, the pocket vibrates, and then while they're davening, they're doing this. No, they're davening from a sitter. I know, I do have my sitter on here. I do daven from that, from Minnesota.
There's
my rose-colored
glasses.
That's a rose-colored glass. That's Don LaHop's foot, lady. Very good for you. See the positive in people. Good. Very good. So yes, the black-white thinking is problematic, but only if that becomes a habit that takes you in the way. Then, because our religious precepts are in some ways, but you know, the funny thing is, I think we are less in some ways black-white thinking than Catholicism, which has a pope who makes one ruling, and that's the ruling. We have a Gemara. The Gemara is so great. The Gemara is such a perfect example of non-black-white thinking. Because on one page, you know, on Daf Aleph is black. Now, 30 pages later, we're white. You know, there's been a whole machloket, and there's been a whole discussion, and there's Beis Hillel, there's Beis Shammai. We're not so black-white. We think we are. But, you know, there's a lot of rabbinic, you know, work around the Torah that gives us some shades of gray. Did I answer you?
Yeah.
Okay. So how do we get past this? How do we move past it? In going from noticing that we're involved in a cycle of thought that's problematic to wanting to make a change, there are two steps, two critical questions that we need to ask. And I think that one of the reasons that we often don't make the changes we need to make is we get stuck on the first question. And the first question is this possibly real? Is this negative thought loop? I'm worried about terrorism in the U.S. I'm worried that we could be, once again, the victims of a terrorist attack. I'm worried about, let's take something less huge but more real. I'm worried about anti-Semitism. I'm worried about acts of anti-Semitism. I saw the limited access I had to TV and news while I was in the Rockies was mostly Canadian, and I know there are a number of Canadians here, so I saw some very disturbing news about protests, pro-Palestinian protests, and some clashes at the protests with someone wearing an Israeli flag, and the Canadian policeman says to the guy wearing the Israeli flag, well, what do you expect coming to this protest wearing that flag? Like, it's all right for us to beat up people in Israeli flags. Don't wear your Israeli flag at a pro-Palestinian protest. Like, there was something wrong with that statement. I found that very disturbing. Add to that all the news about anti-Semitism around the world. So, okay, I have a thought. Anti-Semitism is on the rise. I, my children, we are not safe. That's my thought.
Yes.
Is it true? Yeah?
If you go back to the Yom Kippur War, they find out when they did analyzation, what happened there, one concept was it was a whole self-cheating system. Okay, when you are caught in the concept and you are changing all the facts according to the philosophy that you have, and you regard any kind of other things.
You disregard other facts.
Okay, so how do you balance that when you're going into those questions and self-analyzation? How can you avoid the self-cheating?
So this is, hopefully I'm going to answer your question. If I don't, you'll remind me. So the question one is it true? So I'm going to use my example here. Anti-Semitism is on the rise. This is a dangerous time to be a Jew. Is that true? Can I eliminate that thought and make myself feel better saying, Rona, you're being unreasonable? No, I can't. I can't eliminate the thought based on true. The problem is that very often, again, because many of our negative thought patterns start from reality, they have truth in them, so then I don't go further. I say, oh my gosh, so I'm going to lose sleep, I'm going to feel miserable, I'm going to be stressed out. Then I have to go to question number two. Is carrying this thought repeatedly, prominently in my thinking, is giving it the headline in my daily news helpful? And to answer whether it's helpful, I have to ask, does it help me make better choices? Does it make me feel better? Does it make me a better person in some way? And if the answer to helpful is no, then I'm going to proceed to, okay, so how do I deal with that thinking? Because the thinking is causing me trouble. It is not making me a better person. It is not helping me make better choices. It's not enabling me or empowering me in any way. It's keeping me stuck. It's keeping me limited. The same thing as you were talking about, if the cognitive distortion leads to bad decisions, bad behavior, then we have to think about, so how do I change that thought pattern? There are three major ways to change thinking. None of them are impossible. Thoughts are learned. Thought habits are learned. Thoughts may come into our head unwanted. You can't, you know, if I tell you all right now, do not think of the color purple. You will think of the color purple. It's impossible to banish thoughts. But we do have the ability to train our brain to focus on different things. Interestingly, having worked with particularly medical students from all over the world, from different cultures, from different ideas, this is very easy for us as Jews to think about. Part of our Judaic heritage has the notion of kavana and intent, and that we can focus our minds in a direction in which we choose and in a healthy pro-growth direction. But there are cultures, by the way, where this is, I dealt with one Indian physician in training who absolutely believed, I think erroneously, her ideas of karma were erroneous, that her thoughts were irrelevant because everything was karmic and was predetermined, so that her thoughts had no power. And she also thought she had no power over her thoughts, that they happened in the same way that karma happened. So we have, as a kind of part of our toolbox, the notion that we have control over our thoughts. We can shape our thinking, but how do we do it? Anything that we do to change our thinking pattern, you have to think a little bit like learning to drive or ride a bicycle. Everybody in the room a driver? Yeah? Or a bicycle rider, one or the other, both paradigms work. Where did you first learn? What was the first time you were behind the wheel?
When you experienced it.
When you experienced it, but where? What place did you choose to start?
Driveway at home.
A parking lot, a quiet road, a back street somewhere, not rush hour Midtown Manhattan. You didn't try the Long Island Expressway on a Friday afternoon until you were pretty prolific. And it's the same if you were making another huge Simcha or you were having your cataract surgery tomorrow and you say, oh, I heard Novik today, now I'm going to use these techniques. Piece of cake, I'll take care of that problem. I won't have the negative thinking anymore. Not going to work like that. I'm sorry, I made you nervous. Not tomorrow. Tomorrow's Shabbat. No work. It's not going to work. It takes practice to learn and master these tools to get to the point of automaticity. We drive automatically. I'll tell you how automatically we drive. I almost got a $120 summons today at the Throgs Neck Bridge, because I almost drove through the barrier. So I was in a rental car and forgot that I don't have my Easy Pass. I'm in Easy Pass lane and I don't understand why the thing's not going up. Literally, I stopped this far from it and the policeman says, what are you doing? Where's your Easy Pass? I said, oh my gosh, I'm not in my car. I don't have my Easy Pass. He says, well, you can either pay cash or there'll be a $120 summons. I said, here's my toll. Thank you very much. Automaticity. I don't think I drive through that bridge twice a day. It's automatic. We don't think about it. 90% of our thought process happens without us thinking about it. We go to the dry cleaners, we make Shabbos, we do all of it happens without a lot of mental energy. When things are automatic, they don't zap our mental energy. They're not taking up our cognitive resources because they're automatic. Now, if we have negative thoughts that are automatic, we have to identify them and try these strategies to get beyond them. Question?
There's a lot of talk now about mindfulness. Mm-hmm. There's even talk about bringing it into the school system and you're reading about doctors using mindfulness.
Yes.
Would you say mindfulness is helpful? Would you say it's, is it
I'm not going to, it is helpful. Meditation is one form of achieving mindfulness. It's very helpful. It is a very hard skill to learn in today's world. We are the opposite of mindful. We are so on automatic, and we're also on overload, so that really being in the moment is very difficult for us. It's a great skill. It's very helpful. It's very health promoting. I chose not to include it today because, by the way, I actually find that all of these strategies are easier to address negative mental habits than mindfulness is. Mindfulness is, in a way, emptying yourself of the negative thoughts, and I find that our brain abhors a vacuum. And the minute we say, you know, empty your mind and think of nothing, I don't know about you, my shopping list, the to-do list, all the worries about my kids, the health of my parents, it just, you know, the faucet opens. If I'm busy, if I'm at a meeting, if I'm focused, if I'm, you know, watching a compelling movie or video, those things don't flow in. So to open one's mind to just the moment and the experience and turn that tap off, I find it's a very hard skill to master and learn. So I'm giving you the easier ones. Not that they're easy, but easier. So the first is called, I'm going to do the second one first, thought stopping. It's just what it is, thought stopping. I have that thought, stop. Years ago, people actually did, you know, rubber band on the wrist, and every time I think about that, I'm going to snap and stop the thought. I don't like thought stopping. I don't find it works very well. If you want to find an amazing comic piece, I didn't find it, I should have found it for today, but given the sound is not good, I wouldn't show it, of Bob Newhart doing thought stopping with someone as he plays the role of a therapist in a Saturday Night Live sketch, where the punchline basically is the woman is terrified of small situations, and basically his thought stopping is, stop it, or I'll bury you underground in a box. That's thought stopping. I find it very, very hard to do, and it's not so effective, but if you combine thought stopping with either thought exchange or Socratic method, I think it helps. So what are those two? Thought exchange is also exactly as it sounds. It means, how do I take a current thought pattern? So I'm thinking about the uncertainty and instability of life. I'm thinking about my experiences in the war and how it challenged me to think about life in a positive way. Well, those thoughts, I've answered the question, are they true and valid? Yes. But are they helping me? Maybe they're not helping me. Maybe I'm so focused on the loss and these thoughts that I'm stuck, that I'm unable to move forward, that I'm starting to feel depressed, or I'm feeling very anxious. And so I want to do something about these thoughts. I want to exchange them. When I notice myself thinking in this direction, I want an alternate thought. Now, here's the Pollyanna problem. If the alternate thought I say is, life is wonderful, nobody dies in wars, it's all going to be good, my brain will reject that as quickly as Rona Novick thinking, I'm 6'5" and I weigh 120 pounds. Like, dream on. Not ever happening in my lifetime. My brain, I'm sorry? That's well, but it's real thinking. I'm 5 feet tall on a good day. On a good day. It says on my license, 5 feet tall, because I like to sit really straight. It's the only direction, you know, at this age, the only growth is, you know, my mother's 5 feet two. What? But she's now shorter than I am. And I'm 5 feet tall. So, you know, I did always want to be her height. Now I am her height. So if you're going to do thought exchange, the thought has to be realistic, or your brain will automatically reject it. The thought may be, the army is so careful. There will be loss. There is going to be loss. But it's a price we have to be willing to pay. And I do have hashgacha pratit. There's a larger hand operating here that I'm going to believe in, that I'm going to choose to have faith in an outcome that I can't see the end of, because I believe in a greater power than myself. That I'm going to go in for surgery knowing that I'm in very good hands. I've had one procedure that went well. The other procedure will, I'm sure, be as uneventful as the last one, and that's what I'm going to focus on. It'll be uncomfortable, but that's what I have to deal with. Or there'll be another Simca. I'm just using the examples we had before. There'll be another Simca. I'll be overwhelmed, but I know I'm going to get through it. I've gotten through it before. And think of those wonderful moments that I had when I saw all the grandkids being together. It's replacing it with a thought that is coping. Yes, I'll be anxious going into the surgery, but I was anxious last time and it turned out okay. Even including in our thought process our warts and our foibles, I will be anxious. It's normal for me to be overwhelmed when the house is filled with company. I shouldn't expect that I'm Susie Homemaker. Oh, I'm so happy, everybody come in. You know, it's all right. That's what thought exchange looks like. Now, thought exchange takes practice. Like I said, it's not something that you can say, oh, today I'm going to do X. When my, after 9/11, my sister works for the news media, and after 9/11, she was working crazy hours. She lives in Westchester and was driving over the Tappan Zee Bridge regularly. And she said, Rhonda, every time I drive the bridge, every single time, I'm panicked. I just keep thinking, we're a target, the bridge. I can't do it. And I said, Pam, I can't tell you it's not true. I mean, we just lost two buildings in New York, two buildings that were there. I had to, you know, say to my kids, gone, those buildings that you went to, you were on the top. I remember also my son, I don't remember how old he was at the time, but when I told him that planes had hit the building, he said, okay, so planes hit the building, or did the planes fall down? Like, it didn't occur to him that the buildings were gone. Like, that was an impossibility to him, who had been in, seen the size and scope of those buildings, that the buildings like that could ever be gone. So my sister is saying, nervous about the bridge. Yes, it's true, but is it helping you to think that as you drive over the bridge? No. I said, so we got to come up with another thought for you to have as you drive over the bridge. I said, you do, you know, TV work. What are they saying about Target? They're saying New York is the least likely to be hit right now. After 9/11, the threat went way down in New York because the likelihood of a second and the intensity of the security measures. I said, so that's what your thought needs to be. You need to be driving over the bridge saying, very unlikely, security measures are heightened. The chance of at this moment, at this time, this bridge, it's virtually infinitesimal. More dangerous for me to, you know, cross the street without looking. And that was what her thought exchange was. But it took her days and days and days of thinking that every time she approached the bridge, to get that to be the automatic thought rather than target. So that's thought exchange. The last one is Socratic method. Socratic method simply means a kind of internal arguing or dialogue. It can go anything like the Tanakh argument between Abraham and Hashem over a stone. You know, well, if there were 50 righteous, then what about 40? Well, I think of it in terms of percentages. What's the chance that I'm going to be overwhelmed making this simcha? Is it really likely? How bad do I think it's going to be? Is there a 5%? Is there even a 2% chance that I won't be overwhelmed? Yeah.
The comment you had about anti-Semitism, did you just say it's there, but I'll do something to protect myself? Like,
sure.
I won't wear a kippah.
Right, or, you know, exactly. I might say, look, there's anti-Semitism is growing in the world. That's a very good one to do Socratic dialogue. It's growing very much in the world. But let's, I'm going to argue with myself here. If my mental process, which is negative, is, and it's rampant and I'm not safe anywhere, is, but what evidence do I have of anti-Semitism in my life, in my world? Have there been incidents? Have there been, where I live, where I work, where I go? Am I exposed to it? Am I bothered by it on the TV and in France and in other places? Yes. Should I try to do something about it? Yes. But really, in my neck of the woods, I think I'm okay and I live a fairly comfortable life. Or I might play the odds and say, you know, what are the chances of an anti-Semitic confrontation in my life? Do I think there's a 5% chance, a 10% chance? I think if I lived in Paris, the numbers would be different. You know, if I were walking around, I don't know, pick a hot spot. Maybe, you know, Paris with the yarmulke on. It would be different. We had an experience also, we're coming back, returning our rental car in the airport, and the guy talks to someone at the rental place. He's talking to his colleague in Arabic. And my husband speaks a little Arabic, so my husband says something like, oh, you know, then good evening to you also. And they start a conversation of where he's from. He's actually from Africa. He knows a little bit of Arabic, but he comes from a place, this guy comes from a place near Ethiopia. He speaks a different language. My husband says, oh, I know a few words of Arabic, not a lot. Packing up our bags, we're leaving, and he says, shalom. He's an African-American guy. I mean, he's an African guy, black. And he says to us, shalom. And my husband says, how do you know we were Jewish? I said, well, I'm wearing a tefillah on my head. You're wearing a baseball cap. And it also could be that when we opened the suitcases to repack, there was, you know, Tehillim, a sitter, I mean, maybe he saw something. But, could have been an ugly event, but it was, he said shalom. You know, it was fun. So I can do that with my Socratic method. You know what? There are terrible people in the world, but there also are friends to the Jews in the world, and there are people who are at least, you know, benign or neutral. I play with kids. I turn Socratic method into a game I call Give Me Five. Literally, I say, give me five. For each finger, you need to give me an alternate thought. So if you are personalizing it, the Rebbe's out to get me, that's why I failed the test, I'll say, give me five. You have to give me five other ways of thinking about that. If the child is really, really stuck in their thinking, I'll say three of them can be supernatural. So it could be, you know, the Rebbe was abducted by an evil alien, a witch cast a spell on the Rebbe, the Rebbe had mind control done on him, but at least two of them have to be alternate. You know, maybe I didn't study enough, or, you know, maybe this was really the hardest section of the halakha test, and that's why I didn't do well, and I'm not great in halakha. The point is, what does that give me five do? What does Socratic thinking do? It loosens up the groove we're stuck in, the rigid thought pattern. It forces us to think outside our personal box of where we are sitting and think about a different way of thinking. Before we have to end for Mincha and for questions, I want to just touch on three positive psychology paradigms that are particularly, I think, relevant for some of the issues we talked about in your examples and for positive thinking in general. Gratitude, grit, and meaning making. First of all, gratitude. We, again, have a tradition of Hakarat HaTov, which I think is absolutely amazing how much Jewishness and Jewish thought emphasizes and supports the power of Hakarat HaTov. But increasingly, the research on gratitude and on generosity is showing the benefits to the giver as well as to the receiver. The health-building benefits of an attitude of gratitude, that if you want to feel happier, feel healthier, sleep better, have better relationships, then here's my simple advice. Every single night before you go to bed, or ritualize it, before you go to bed, at your dinner, you have to write it. Write down 2 to 3 things that you are grateful for, that you are thankful for, that were positive in your day. That alone in research, increased health, increased relationships, increased sleep, decreased sleep problems. Phenomenal. So simple. And I would say to those of you who are physicians who are working with ill patients, my experience working particularly with physically ill children, medically ill children and their families, is that very often the illness becomes your life. I hear children all the time who are physically ill talk about, I don't want to be my illness. I don't want people to look at me as the cancer. Look at me as the diabetic. Look at me as the CF patient. I want people to just see me for who I am. One of the things I think this exercise does, and it's relevant to your point at the very beginning about, you know, not feeling guilty about the illness, is what I would say to someone is make it separate from the illness. In other words, the three things shouldn't be, they could be, you know, my numbers were good on my blood test today. But that's not all you are. Maybe the ice cream tasted really, really good at the ice cream store. You know, or maybe there was a rainbow outside. Or maybe it was really nice and sunny when you sat out on the bench. You know, whatever it is that you're grateful and that you're thankful for, or that someone was nice to you. This is another, we have Torontonians here. So the Toronto airport, we flew through Toronto, has two people, every time I fly, they're there. At security, there's a guy who takes your bags, also an African-American guy, do you know what I'm talking about? He sings, he dances, as he's slipping everybody's bags, and then there's the woman who checks your you know, thing and tells you which line to go in security. There was a group of like six girls traveling. She says, okay, girls, I need to have on three a good morning. It's 6:30 in the morning. Okay. I've just laid over on a red eye. And one, two, three, good morning. And, you know, and her response to everyone is, life is full of blessings. Find the blessings. Have your blessings. This is a woman who understands gratitude. And just, you know, dishes it out. Anyone will have it at 6:30 in the morning. But I've seen both those people now, like the three or four times I've flown to Toronto. So gratitude and thinking about where, this goes very much, by the way, this is, gratitude is the antidote to the dark colored glasses. It really is looking at life half full, looking at what you have, being thankful and appreciating the pluses, even acknowledging, not being Pollyanna, acknowledging that there are minuses and that there are problems. Grit. Grit is the antidote to learned helplessness. Grit is perseverance. Grit is the not only the pushing through, but it's the belief in the value and the ability to push through difficulties. Again, I think this is an incredibly consonant with Jewish thought notion. We are a tough nation. We are a tough people. We understand that adversity happens, but that hard work is also an important part of growth. Things don't come without work, without effort, and that the work's okay. So that kind of paradigm is very helpful. And again, an enormous amount of research now in the field of psychology looking at what gives people grit, what allows them to keep moving forward in difficult times, and how do we build it in our children and make it part of kind of a school curriculum and a focus so that we are building the next generation of hard workers, because things have gotten progressively easier for generation after generation. And so I don't think anybody, by the way, in the Depression or in World War I, I don't think anyone was looking around saying, you know, how do we make grit in people? They were living life that required grit. Survival required grit. Nowadays, you know, people assume that survival means, you know, two cars, three iPods, four, you know, electronic. This is also, I have all these stories from vacation. We're walking around Emerald Lake, this beautiful hike, it's idyllic, and we meet a family that has two canoes on the lake and three small kids, two different families, and one little boy does not want to go into his appointed canoe. He wants to go in the other canoe, but it will put them over the limit of too many kids in the canoe, and no, you've got to go in the other canoe. No, I don't want to go in the canoe. Mommy says, I'll let you play with my iPhone. Okay. And I'm thinking, we are in the most beautiful spot. Your parents are taking you in a canoe, and the only thing that will get you in it is a play-in with the iPhone. It's hard these days, I think, to get our generation to understand, the younger generation to understand the need for and the value of grit. So that's important. And the last is meaning making. Research in the area of, a lot of the research comes out of end of life research, but in other areas as well, research in the field of spirituality continues to document that people who have meaning and are able to assign meaning to their lives at large and to traumatic or difficult events like life-ending illnesses in their lives have better outcomes, have lower needs for pain medication, have less psychological distress and need for psychiatric medication. Even lower nursing calls were found in hospitals, in hospice and in other critical care facilities. When you have people who are able to wrap, and this is a cognitive process, they're wrapping their medical challenges inside a meaning, inside something that has it make sense. It's not, now here's where we have to be careful about the guilt-inducing. I don't think any of us who work with people who are struggling, people who have challenges in their lives, I mean, can you imagine going to a Shiva house and saying, you know, you seem awfully sad. I think you should have some better meaning to assign to your loved one's life. I mean, come on now. Get with it. Or to say to an ill patient or, God forbid, a dying patient, you know, have you thought about where this sits in your life overall and what this means and how you define this? You don't yell at people to make meaning. You can't make people feel guilty if they say, I don't understand why this is happening to me. All we can say is that maybe part of your journey can be thinking about that. Maybe you want to talk with someone, a spiritual person, a mental health person, a friend, a neighbor, someone who's been through it, to see how you make meaning of it, because the act of making meaning can make you feel better. It can contribute to you feeling better, even though making meaning doesn't change your reality. Making meaning, I can make all kinds of meaning out of anti-Semitism, not in, I can make it in the small and in the big. In other words, I can, from a small thing, I can look from a historical, geopolitical reasoning, I can come up with all kinds of explanations why anti-Semitism is currently on the rise. I could even, from a hashkafic and spiritual point of view, say, aha, I can see the hand of God and why I can understand the message that Hashem is trying, I'm not saying I feel this way, I'm saying you could, one could say, I understand this, I put it in a meaning. That doesn't change the reality. It doesn't make it any safer to be walking around, you know, in certain parts of the world nowadays. So one of the caveats of all of our cognitive work is it doesn't change the world. It changes our experience of it, and in that way allows us to engage with the world in healthy and helpful ways. I'll leave you with this image and then I'll take any questions that you have. The idea of healthy thinking is part of building our resilience. It's one more tool we have in our toolbox to be strong and healthy. A lot of the work that I've done around resilience is not only over man-made events and tragedies, but it's also living in the East Coast, the most common event we have to deal with are hurricanes and major storms. And the paradigm for resilience, you know, we tend to think there are expressions like being strong as an oak. Well, if you live in my neck of the woods and a hurricane or a big storm comes along, an oak is not a good paradigm. You know? Those oaks crush trees, they fall. There was actually in Virginia, there was a horrible accident with the horrible death this weekend, I heard, with a tornado. Tornadoes are rare here, but we get hurricanes a lot. And oaks, and those big, strong, tall trees, they're the first to go. They break off because they are rigid and fixed. Watch when hurricanes happen in the tropics. Watch the palm trees. Palm trees are flexible. They bend almost in half. They'll bend, they'll look like an inverted U, touching the ground at high winds. And then when the wind's gone, they come back up. That's resilience, is bouncing back. It's being able to have the flexibility and fluidity in our toolbox, mentally as well as in other ways, that allows us to bounce back. I wish you all a cognitively enlightening and pleasant Shabbat Shalom. And I'm open to any questions or comments. Yes.
Really, I just regret you just said that you didn't really give any ways to work on it.
A lot of the work out of cognitive psychology, working on writ has to do with the issue of failure and what role failure plays. I think that we've become very, very focused in, at least in American culture, and I work in education, so No Child Left Behind has been a disaster in my mind for grit. Because what No Child Left Behind did was it focused on scores, and it made failure not an option. We're not about growth, we're about a number. We're not about how you do things or how you get there, just get the number. What we really want, in my mind, you know, when I rule the world, education will be about the journey, not about the number. It will be about all of the failures and what they taught you. The son who's here also, I'm glad he's not in the room, I'm telling all these stories about him. When he had to learn to ride a bike, I think the first time he fell off the bike, he was one of those kids who threw the bike down and said, "Bikes are stupid, that's it, I'm never riding a bike, I'm never going on the bike again, I'm not going to," because he does not like imperfection. And he didn't want to fall. And the way that I got him back on the bike was I told him, it's good when you're still a little smarter than your children, I told him that, oh, honey, I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you. You know, it's really, really important when you learn to ride a bike that you fall at least 5 times every lock. Because otherwise your muscles don't get strong enough and your balance in your inner ear doesn't get modulated. And I made it sound really scientific and, you know, like mommy's kind of a doctor. So you have to fall. I said, if you do it only 3 times this block, all right. But really, like, try to do 5 falls here and the corner. And then he learned to ride a bike. So, and that's just a funny example, but Reed's a great. I mean, Reed quotes from, if you just do a Google search on, you know, quotes about failure, Michael Jordan has an amazing quote about, yes, he got this many, you know, shots in and this many, but how many failures did he have to get to those statistics? Raising boys, I've learned a lot about baseball, and being in high schools and junior high schools, I say all the time, you know, a really good batting average is like 300, is amazing. That means 2 out of 3 times you miss. That's a lot of failure. And we still consider that amazing performance. So we have to think about that in the rest of our lives and realize that to become amazing, you fail a lot. I was at a workshop on positive psychology with Tal Ben Shachar's group from Israel, and they showed a video in their curriculum. They use a video, I can't remember who made it, it's Nike or one of those, that's of an athlete running in an Olympic track race, I think it's women. She falls down, she winds up getting up and winning the race. And interestingly, all psychologists and educators, we were furious. We were furious at that video. Because we said, in life, you fall down, you get up, you keep running, that's great. But to end with her winning the race, that's an unreasonable message to give to kids. That's, to me, that's not grit. To me, that's Pollyanna. A lot of times we fall down. To me, the glory is that you ran the race. That you made it to the finish line, even if you were last. Even if you came 3 days after everybody else finished. So I think that's the way we promote grit. Very, very hard to do it in our standard-based environment. That even if you look at Lamune Kodesh, we will have high school boys and girls to some extent, but boys are worried about, you know, which seminary, which program am I going to get into, which yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. So I have to really know a lot of my Gemara, in high school. Go back to middle school, now I'm worried, will I get in the right shear for high school, because then if I'm not in the right shear, then I won't get in the right, then go back to elementary school, and as well, if I'm not in the high classes, then I'm not going to make it into the right shear, then I'm not going to make, to the point where, by kindergarten already, we're now worrying kids about the standard they're reaching, rather than just keep at it, just keep working. The fact that you're working is a great thing.
I'm a teacher, we're loaded with totally unrealistic expectations. Grades for sure. If any teacher can honestly tell you his A ratio, you know, it's ridiculous. In right. Jewish schools, and parents are the biggest problem going on.
Yeah.
They're totally under the expectation of what their kid can do and will do.
Well, parents are only the problem, again, because if we start at the top, if universities and yeshivos and seminaries would say, we're really looking for someone who has grit, not who, you know, has an A, we'd be in a different place. But here's the other problem. You know, it's very easy for me to say, we want grit and gratitude. These are much harder to measure. Grades are much easier to measure. The reason that we, in No Child Left Behind laws in the U.S., that we started with reading and then math and now history and science, is those are easier outcomes to measure than humanity. We do not care in the U.S. educational system right now about whether you're a mensch when you graduate school. You could be an axe murderer as long as you know your math, science, English, and social studies. We consider you an educational success in the U.S. That's because measuring niceness, humanity, menschlichkeit, ehrlichness is much harder. It's much, again, I'll date myself. There was, on our report cards growing up, a grade for civility or citizenship. And by citizenship, they didn't mean, can you vote? They meant, are you a positive element in the community of learners in this school? Are you a force for the good? That's hard. It's very difficult to measure. It's somewhat moralistic. You know, who would I want? Someone raised the issue, the direction America's going in. Would I want the public government in America to decide who is a good person?
Well, sure. We have a fucked, at least quasi-Tabri Yeshiva. They have a very detailed, my son's Yeshiva has a very detailed Benonu Haber report card.
Beautiful.
Ben Haberim with their name,
right.
With respect, and like five different grades.
So that's, you know, I think our schools are empowered to do more, and many of them are doing more through MIDO program, through curricula. We don't have to be limited to what the national standards are. Yeah.
Thank you for the wonderful lecture. I found it really interesting personally and also professionally because I'm a medical oncologist and I specialize in treating young women with breast cancer. These are a lot of tricks I can help my patients with. What I'm stuck on is meaning, is making meaning. How do you make meaning of a young woman dying of breast cancer?
How can you make an oncologist who works with young women with breast cancer, how can you make meaning of a young woman dying of breast cancer? I don't know how you make, how one makes meaning of any death. Granted, you know, the death of someone at 120 who's lived a full life is a much easier meaning making than of a young woman who leaves the family. But I think how one makes meaning of that is personal. And I think that's, there isn't a way to make meaning. Some people make meaning by setting up foundations, and that's the meaning of a person's life. Some people make meaning in a very personal way by saying, we're going to keep this person's spirit as part of our family with this tradition that this woman started. That making meaning is not explaining how or why this happened. It's situating it in your life in a way that it keeps you from being stuck, that it gives you a key or a clue forward. And I think, again, every family does that differently. I mean, I've had several breast cancer survivors in my practice over the years, none of whom, it's not my practice. I have a very small practice now, it was larger years ago, and I work mostly with children, but children come attached to parents. And so over the years, a number of living in Napa County and working in Napa County where, you know, we have an incredibly high breast cancer rate among Jewish women, a lot of women just happened to go through their breast cancer while I was working with their family. And one woman really believed that this was the vehicle that changed her view on health for her family and on nutrition. Now, I thought that was a little, for me, that was a little crazy. I mean, she was almost at the point of saying, it's a bracha that this happened because now I got really into macrobiotics and health and all these kind of things. But it worked for her. It was her way of moving forward rather than being stuck
with
it.
Yeah, those things work for survivors. The problem is, you know, and there aren't a lot of, you know, 25 or 30-year-old women who are going to leave foundations. They may not even have children that they can leave, you know, a video or letters to, you know, open when you get married, open
right.
when you have your first baby. And, like, I'm always struggling to find something for these women.
I think the struggle is that you can't find it for them. You can only open the door to them and say, this may be something you want to think about, is where
where you want to leave your mark, what you want this to be, how you want to be remembered. It's a very hard conversation to have with a young person. You know, you can think about that with someone in their, you know, 80s or 90s, maybe, and even then it's difficult. But to say to someone, I think it's also a hard conversation because you don't, you're always balancing, as an oncologist of any kind, you're always balancing hope and reality. And you don't want to say, well, let's think about the end game if there's still potential for, you know, other measures, for curative measures, et cetera. But to open the dialogue and the discussion and to say, some people find it helpful to think about, you know, what this has, and what impact it's had on them, on their world, on their family, what impact they want it to have. Some people do advocacy. I mean, for some people, their meaning comes in advocacy. I, you know, before I go, I want to start a petition. I want there to be better, you know, mammogram screening for young women. I want this, you know, done in my, that's my final request.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Thank you all. Think happy. Oh.